Miami Beach backs away from a free speech battle. Venezuelan migrants are labeled terrorists because of tattoos. And after 40 years, Radio Martí goes off the air in Cuba. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll review the dispute that ended this week in Miami Beach about O Cinema's screening of a controversial Oscar-winning documentary about Israel and Palestinians. Why are free speech disputes so common here? We'll also talk to the Miami attorney of one of the Venezuelan migrants who was deported, perhaps illegally, to El Salvador last weekend, and we'll examine the dismantling of Radio and TV Martí and their actual effect on the Cuban regime. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos. Bienveni, benvindo. It was just a couple weeks ago that we had the Palm Beach Post's former editorial page editor, Tony Doris, on our program to talk about a political cartoon he'd published that got him fired. The reason? Even though the cartoon criticized the Israeli military's conduct in the Gaza War, local Jewish organizations insisted it was anti-Semitic. No sooner had we finished that discussion, with all its free speech ramifications, then we heard of a new and similar local dispute. Miami Beach Mayor Stephen Miner wanted to evict the O Cinema Theater from a city-owned building because it screened an Oscar-winning documentary about Israel and Palestinians that, again, critics called anti-Semitic. This week, Miner dropped the eviction effort, but the episode again raised an issue that too often hangs over this community. Namely, do we have too little tolerance for open discussion of sensitive subjects? Gaza, Cuba, you name it. Are we too cavalier about the First Amendment here? We, of course, want to know what you think. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now to discuss the O Cinema debate and the free speech disputes that so often arise in South Florida is Miami attorney Katie Blankenship. She is the senior director and counsel in Florida for the nonprofit PEN America, which advocates for free expression. Katie, many thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So the film in question that O Cinema showed is No Other Land. It chronicles the Israeli military's demolition of Palestinian-owned homes in the West Bank, leaving those Palestinians with, as the title tells us, no other land. Critics call it anti-Israel propaganda, but it was directed by Palestinian and Israeli filmmakers, and this month it won the Oscar for Best Documentary. Still, Miami Beach Mayor Stephen Miner called No Other Land anti-Semitic, and that was his rationale for wanting to evict O Cinema. Katie, what struck you most about this chain of events and how it got to this point?
What struck me most is where is the First Amendment? And how have we lost sight so clearly of the First Amendment and by state actors who are charged with upholding the First Amendment? This represents what we call in the constitutional context blatant viewpoint discrimination, which the government is prohibited from doing, and that the mayor should be well aware of, as well as the city council. It's concerning that we see emotions run so high on certain issues as to warp the very clear confines, strictures, rules of our First Amendment freedoms.
A central concern here is this conflation of issues we see time and again. For example, those who simply criticize Cuban exile politics being accused of outright supporting Cuban communism. In this instance, it's equating criticism of the Israeli government with anti-Semitism. Why do we so often see those leaps of logic here and the chilling effect they can have on free speech and discourse?
Yes, unfortunately, this is a common way that we see First Amendment rights tread upon. Right. And while there is certainly a dangerous conflation of criticism of the Israeli government with anti-Semitism, and is a trend we've seen in Florida and from Governor DeSantis himself in ways that tread upon First Amendment rights, using a banner of anti-Semitism in a way that treads upon every Floridian's First Amendment freedoms is highly problematic. So obviously the mayor has every right to feel how he feels about this, and he has every right to choose to see the film or not, to take his family and friends to see the film or not. That's certainly their choice. He can even, in his personal space, talk about how he feels about that with his family and friends. What he cannot do, and what the Council of Miami Beach cannot do, is impute their own personal feelings about the politics, the actions of the Israeli government, their feelings about what they have determined as anti-Semitic or not, in a way that violates and the First Amendment and uses their own personal feelings to basically institutionalize viewpoint discrimination.
So I want to listen here to two voices on both sides in this discussion. The first is Vivian Martel, O Cinema CEO, who said this when I asked her this week about the accusation that the documentary No Other Land is anti-Semitic, which she denies.
We never set out to offend anybody. On the contrary, we find ourselves as a vehicle for putting out opportunities for conversations. I mean, it's been part of our history and our mission for over 14 years. I mean, we've been serving Miami Beach for 10 of those years. We've been hosting the Miami Jewish Film Festival since 2014. There is a criteria that filmmakers develop when they're telling their narrative arc. There's no one definition that a particular documentary has to be two-sided, 360 degree or not. It's a perspective, and that's what we were sharing.
Now, I should point out we did reach out to Mayor Miner in Miami Beach to join this discussion. He did not get back to us. But there is a gentleman who spoke at the Miami Beach meeting this week where Mayor Miner backed off his proposal to evict O Cinema. His name is Gabriel Groisman. He's an Aventura attorney and former mayor of Bal Harbour. And he told me the problem here isn't so much anti-Semitism, he thinks, but gross insensitivity.
It's not about whether or not this film is anti-Semitic, but what I can say is that it is a piece of propaganda aimed to distort what's happening in Israel. And I think the point that the mayor was trying to make that I actually agree with is that to play it in the heart of Miami Beach, which has one of the largest Jewish communities in our state, is akin to playing a documentary about the KKK in the middle of Liberty City. Nobody would be arguing that that's not inflammatory to that community.
Katie, let's unpack both points there. I want to focus first on that last part of Vivian Martel's defense of the documentary, specifically that we can't expect a film like this to be fair in the sense, say, that one of my news stories is expected to be fair, and that what does matter is the discussion it evokes, even if it risks offending a certain community. What are your thoughts about that point that she made?
I think you've hit on the critical point here, and what she says is so critical. Let's talk about this word offense, right? This idea that we should allow the state to impede on our artistic, cultural, educational freedoms and expressions based on the fear of offending people. That is exactly why we have the First Amendment. It is exactly why we have the right to free expression, right? Because if we allow the state to start using a subjective idea of offense, and I think it's worth noting that there are many, many, many people, not only throughout the world, but in this city, in Miami, that would find the statements by this gentleman equating this film to the KKK in Liberty City as highly offensive. But you know what? I protect his right to say it, no matter how misguided, no matter how he, warps the First Amendment in his assessment. So this idea of allowing subjective offense by state actors is the definition of state censorship. It is the definition of a slippery slope of limiting our artistic and cultural expression. We have to be able to withstand and be a society, a pluralistic society that not only allows but welcomes a diversity of opinions and thought. These filmmakers, to limit their artistic expression because of an idea that they somehow have to present both sides, or that certain members of a community are going to be offended by their film, then it's the United States of America, folks, and just don't go see it, right? Because if we start allowing them to use their subjective offense, then we are living in a censored state.
But regardless of what you might think of Mr. Groisman's argument there that, this would be akin to showing a KKK film in Liberty City, whether that's valid or not, and I think a lot of people would question it. Let's turn, though, to his point that offending a community can be a criterion for a local government like Miami Beach to make when it comes to whether a film like this should be shown. That point specifically, could you address?
It's a very easy point to address. He's dead wrong. He's just wrong.
Okay.
This is well-established constitutional precedent.
Mm-hmm.
There is no question when we look at how the First Amendment has been applied by our Supreme Court for decades, hundreds of years, that we have created and rely on these constitutional liberties, our personal free liberties, to prevent this sort of government overreach. It is exactly the point.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
I want to play then another comment from O Cinema's Vivian Martell about where she thinks Miami Beach got it wrong in this dispute.
They mixed their personal feelings, perhaps, with their duties as government officials. I believe that they negated the First Amendment and the ability for free speech by threatening us. That was a little bit off the rails.
Okay, Katie, she sort of refers to what you were mentioning earlier, but from where you sit as a free speech advocate, does it feel to you that Mayor Minor and others who branded this film as anti-Semitic or at least insensitive, if not harmful, to the Jewish community, did they let their personal feelings push them, as Martell says there, off the First Amendment rails?
Certainly, certainly. And really, the conversation is not even about this film. Right? The substance of the film, in reality, is immaterial. The question is, do state actors get to use their own personal subjective feelings to limit cultural artistic expression? No, they do not.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with PEN America Florida director Katie Blankenship about the O Cinema controversy in Miami Beach and other free speech issues we seem to have so many of in this community. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. We have Eva on the line. Eva, what are your perspectives on this issue?
Well, being a Jewish person and a second-generation Holocaust survivor, there are things that can be against a expression that can hurt people, but showing a movie is not hurting anyone.
Okay.
As opposed to my uncle speaking up when Nazis wanted to march in a highly Jewish community in Skokie, Illinois.
Right.
But this is not about it. This is about showing a movie that was made by both Jews and Palestinians, and people be able to watch it and make their own opinions of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks, Evan. I'm glad you brought that up about Skokie. I was actually a young reporter in Chicago when the Nazis wanted to march through Skokie, and the ACLU, I remember, backed them up, backed up their right to do so. Katie, looking at hearing what Eva just said, and that Skokie example she brought up, how important is that consideration?
I think she makes an excellent point. And I think that case is an excellent point, right? You know, before joining PEN America, I worked for the ACLU. And this is a case that caused a lot of controversy within the ACLU. It's uncomfortable. You know, we don't want to speak for and advocate the rights of the KKK and other folks like that in those situations. But the First Amendment is for everyone. And we have to be able to withstand speech that makes us uncomfortable so that we protect these rights.
Right.
Because it's just what I said earlier, this is a slippery slope. And the answer to speech that someone may find subjectively offensive is more speech.
Right. I also want to ask you about the effects that free speech controversies of this nature can have. Let me play one more point Vivian Martell of O Cinema made.
If organizations and art houses like ourselves are shut down due to these infringements on our free speech, it will only be cascading. We have the ability to reach more audience by measure of the availability of art house fare and the availability in terms of the price for people to partake in this. It's also something that we do in community. We are the front lines of art and culture. And if, you know, we get silenced, it will be, the implications are just unbelievable.
So Martel there talks about the cascading effect that infringements of free speech of this nature can have. Katie, can you elaborate on that from your perspective as the director of Penn here in Florida?
Certainly. And you've hit on it earlier in our interview. This is not an isolated incident in Miami. This is not an isolated incident in the state of Florida. We have seen a level of government overreach and First Amendment violations that has put us in a position that not only is undermining the very core principles of our democracy, but leads to a gross chilling of speech, right? PEN America has tracked that Florida is the number one book banner in the country, right? So what is happening with our teachers in this state? They have no other option but to chill their speech. They have been told that they will be subject to potentially losing their license, which affects them throughout the entire country. They're threatened with criminal prosecution for vague rules that look at targeting viewpoints and identities that this state and the leaders of this state have, you know, found, you know, non-palatable for them. It's something that they don't like personally. It is their subjective opinion masquerading as justification from the state to create a crisis of censorship,
right,
and a real First Amendment crisis. And the chilling of speech is not only the result, but I would argue it is the goal. It is the goal of this, of the censorship crisis that we have seen, and the censorship strategy from the DeSantis administration, that is to create a level and an environment within our state to create fear.
Right.
And what does fear create? It creates an environment where we have our speech chilled. We see this on our university campuses. We see it through the mm-hmm. K-12 system. And we see it now in our artistic and cultural spaces, just like what's happening at O Cinema.
Well, the Miami Beach dispute isn't exactly over, in the sense that there's still a proposal there in the city to compel institutions like O Cinema to make its offerings more balanced, show a more pro-Israel film, for example, or maybe, you know, a film about what you know, happened on October 7th, what Hamas terrorists did to Israeli citizens there. And here I want to turn once more to Gabriel Groysman, who made this argument at this week's Miami Beach meeting.
I'm here just to point out the naked hypocrisy of the crowd here in the room today. If O Cinema was playing a movie about President Trump, they would all be here as well, urging the city to cancel the lease or to cancel the showing. And the proposal that is being put forward today about fairness, it's incredible to me that we don't have a room full of people saying, we're all for free art, for arts, and for all different viewpoints. We should have all kinds of movies in this theater. Everyone should be supporting that if they were being honest.
So, Katie, just finally here in the last 30 seconds we have, what do you think about this so-called fair and balanced requirement for a theater like O Cinema to put forward?
I think, I'm sure to plenty of listeners, fair and balanced sounds like something that makes sense. What he's really saying is, let's allow the state to tell us what we get to watch, what artists get to produce, and create, again, viewpoint discrimination. This is just strictly not legal. And the city of Miami Beach needs to tread very carefully here, realign themselves to their obligations as public servants, because if there is any sort of institution of that sort of viewpoint discrimination and requirements, no, they're going to be looking at heavy litigation costs that they're very unlikely to win, when there is so much Supreme Court precedent that says the exact opposite of what they're arguing.
That may very well be. You're right. Katie Blankenship is the Florida Senior Director and Counsel for PEN America here in Florida. Katie, many thanks.
Thanks so much for covering it. Appreciate the time.
Still to come, was a Venezuelan migrant deported as a terrorist because of a tattoo celebrating his child? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. The past couple months have not been particularly good for the Venezuelan community here. Last month, President Trump stripped hundreds of thousands of Venezuelan migrants of their temporary protected status, or TPS, which shielded them from deportation. Then last weekend, the Trump administration deported more than 200 other Venezuelan migrants to a high-security prison in El Salvador because, it said, they were members of the violent Venezuelan criminal gang called Tren de Aragua. Except It turns out many of them most likely were not gang members or terrorists, as the Trump administration called them. Many had no criminal records in the U.S. or Venezuela, and many may have been arbitrarily accused of gang membership simply because of their tattoos. That includes 26-year-old Venezuelan asylum seeker Franco Caraballo, who we now know was on the deportation flight to El Salvador, which may have taken off in defiance of a federal judge's order not to. What are your thoughts about this deportation dispute? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio is the Miami immigration attorney who represents Franco Caraballo, Martin Rosenau of Coconut Grove. Also with us is his Venezuelan-born wife and immigration law partner, Juliana Taramasco. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, Tim.
Thank you so much for having us here.
Martin, tell us about Franco Caraballo, who's now sitting in the notorious high-security prison for terrorists in El Salvador, on the basis, it appears, of his tattoo. Who is Franco, and what was the tattoo?
So Franco is a 26-year-old young man who grew up in a rough upbringing in Venezuela, but rough because it's economically depressed and the societal conditions there.
He's from Jaracuy State in Venezuela, sort of a rather rural state, right?
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. That's right. And so, you know, since he was 13, he's been a barber, right? So he works hard. According to his wife, when he was here in the United States, he worked from Monday to Monday, nonstop, working as a barber part-time and in construction part-time. Mm-hmm. He's a father of two very, very cute little girls, a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old. Mm-hmm. And it's the 4-year-old whose name,
right,
Shalomé, resulted in, because of the tattoos that he has in tribute to her, caused the questions where they supposedly linked and allegedly linked him as a member of...
Right, because the tattoo being a clock that shows the exact time his daughter was born, which is a very popular tattoo I've seen on the internet. It's a very popular tattoo in Venezuela, but U.S. authorities have identified it as a favorite tattoo of the Tren de Aragua gang. So we'll get to that more in a little bit. Juliana, tell us about all the Venezuelans like Franco Caraballo and his wife, Johanny Sanchez, who came over the border with him 2 years ago seeking asylum. All these Venezuelans who in the past few years have made this massive exodus from their country to the U.S. to seek asylum, humanitarian parole, or TPS. We're talking about almost 8 million people, almost a quarter of Venezuela's population in the past decade. Remind us what it is people like Franco are escaping.
So basically my country, I am 32 years old and I don't remember other government more than Hugo Chavez and Nicolas Maduro. In my country, people doesn't have access to a hospital. The hospital, if you go to the hospital, they don't even have alcohol. So you have to take it with you to see a doctor.
Right, because this regime is widely assumed responsible for the worst humanitarian crisis in modern South American history, economically and politically.
Correct. Yeah. So access to food. When I was there in Venezuela, you will have to make a line to get milk, to get sugar, to get coffee. Now you can get it easier, but you have to pay with dollars. And people like Franco and the majority of my country doesn't have access to pay for those products that are from other countries. So
right,
that's the biggest problem, education.
What about the political repression as well? I mean, one of the reasons, at least Franco's wife, Johanny, told me that he was escaping Venezuela because he had been taking part in opposition marches, got arrested for that, spent a couple days in jail and got roughed up. Is that a common story for a lot of the Venezuelans coming here?
It is. And at this point, you disappear. There's no one who can tell you where you are, where your family can find you. You don't have access to an attorney. And that's the biggest problem right now.
Yep.
The irony there, Tim, is mm-hmm. now he finds himself in exactly that same situation,
right,
where he gets shipped out to a prison where he has no access and an indefinite sentence, apparently.
Well, walk us through then, Martin, what happened to Franco Caraballo, which, as I mentioned earlier, seems very similar to what happened to many of the other 238 Venezuelan migrants who were deported to El Salvador last weekend. Walk us through how Franco got to this situation.
Okay, so Franco had arrived in October of 2023. Mm-hmm. He applied for asylum at the border. He turned himself in, and he was given prosecutorial discretion by ICE to pursue his asylum
claim. Now, he turned himself in. One of the things that I noticed on the court documents in his case is that ICE suddenly made this assertion that he wasn't only being deported because he's, quote, a member of the Tren de Aragua criminal gang, but also because he turned himself over at a point on the border that was not, quote, an appropriate lawful site. What is ICE trying to say, and what should other immigrants and immigration attorneys be aware of in that regard?
So that's an inconsistency in that document, which is his record of deportable alien, which is more recent. Mm-hmm. When he first arrived, he was issued what's called an NTA, a notice to appear, where they specify that he did enter at a port of entry.
At an appropriate
port of entry.
But now they're saying that he didn't.
Right.
Okay.
So it's an error in the document that's pretty blatant because he did turn himself in.
So he applies for asylum, and he was going to one of the asylum application appointments on February 3rd in Dallas, Texas, at the Immigration and Customs Enforcement facility there. What happened?
So he had previously checked in on January 7th before the change in the administration. And on that date, while he was duly reporting, he went on February 3rd, and he was taken into custody right away.
And largely because an ICE agent noticed
a tattoo.
The mm-hmm. tattoo, the clock yeah, tattoo the that clock you and I tattoo. Were just talking about.
That's right.
So he's detained, and you're trying to watch him on the ICE locator records. And then last Friday or Saturday, he suddenly...
He disappeared.
Disappears from those, and that's when you knew.
That's when I knew that he had to be on the plane.
Okay. So again, we should point out that he's on that plane because he's been accused of being a member of the Tren de Aragua criminal gang. Juliana, since this Tren de Aragua gang is so central to this whole controversy, tell us more about Tren de Aragua and why it's become such a lightning rod for anti-immigration sentiment, not just in the U.S., but in several other countries like Chile, you know, where a lot of Venezuelan migrants have gone to as well.
Honestly, when I was in Venezuela, it was not a big deal. This group was from a jail called Tocorón.
In the state of Aragua.
Yes.
Hence its name, origin. Tren de Aragua. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So right now, every news that you see that has to do with Venezuelan is a member of Tren de Aragua.
Yeah.
So
yeah, and I want to get to that discrimination a little later in our conversation.
So
yeah.
Basically, it feels like every Venezuelan right now it's a Tren de Aragua member. It's not like that, and I'm sure that there are criminals that are criminal from every nationality, including mine, mm-hmm. but we are not all criminals.
Sure.
For me, it's very important that people knows that we didn't leave our country because we wanted to, but we had to survive, basically.
But Tren de Aragua did have a presence, not just in countries like Chile, as I mentioned, but it was a problem last year, for example, and in previous years in cities like New York, Aurora, Colorado. It did cause enough of a problem that it seemed to have made it easier for President Trump, at least in his presidential campaign last year, to make Tren de Aragua sort of the poster child for migrant criminality, no?
Yeah.
How did that affect the Venezuelan community?
Well, now I'm as a Venezuelan, I'm afraid that people are going to think that me or my friends or my family, we are members of that criminal gang, and we're not, because it's such a big deal. And I understand that crimes should be a big deal, and nobody should be allowed to do that. But not everyone who came from my country
sure.
are Tren de Aragua related to them.
Mm-hmm. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Miami immigration lawyers Martin Rosenau and Juliana Taramasco, whose firm represents one of the Venezuelan migrants caught up in last weekend's controversial deportation to El Salvador. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. And a reminder that if you miss any part of the program, you can search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. Martin, U.S. District Judge James Boasberg tried to halt the deportation flight that took those Venezuelan migrants to El Salvador last weekend. His concern was the Trump administration's use of the 1798 Alien Enemies Act and the designation of these migrants like Franco Caraballo as, quote, terrorists. Critics argue evoking the Alien Enemies Act gave the feds more carte blanche to arbitrarily finger these migrants as trained the Aragua terrorists based on things, as we said, like tattoos. Do you and other attorneys you've spoken with who represent these migrants feel the Trump administration ignored the judge's orders to stop this flight because it knew many of these migrants are not gang members?
So my estimation is that I know they ignored it, right? It's clear that they ignored the order.
I should say that the Trump administration has claimed that they weren't, that their rationale or their argument is that the flight was already over international waters and it was too late to turn it around to comply with his order. But again, that's their side of things.
So for me, I feel like they indiscriminately rounded up so many individuals that, yes, they probably did do it, knowing that many, and they wanted to get them there before the public at large and the court found out that in reality, contrary to what Catherine Levitt was saying, that 100% of these people were vetted and it's like completely clear to them that they are members of Tren de Aragua.
Catherine Levitt being the White House's press spokesperson. And again, that question of vetting, again, you look at the court records for Franco Caraballo, it plainly mentions he has no criminal record in the U.S., and the documents from Venezuela show that he had no criminal record. And so stretches credulity when the Trump administration says we were really investigating these guys, no?
Right, and they just came into power about a month ago, you know? So yeah. How well were they able to vet these individuals?
And,
right.
And now members of the government are saying that maybe not all of them are criminals, so they can send them to Venezuela. But what happened if a person has an asylum? You cannot go back to Venezuela.
Right. And that's the other question I wanted to bring up with it. Franco Caraballo was supposed to have a hearing in Texas on his case this past Wednesday.
There's an update there, Tim.
Oh, sure.
He's been scheduled, curiously, for July 2nd. So it seems to be that the immigration judge on this case has acknowledged that there's at least a possibility that he will be brought back, right? Something that I view as favorable for him.
But have you ever seen a case where someone had a hearing on their case like this scheduled on a certain date, but yet they were allowed to be deported before that hearing, which seems to be a very flagrant violation of due process, no?
So this is unprecedented. There have been isolated incidents in the past where ICE has mistakenly deported someone mid-proceedings, and they've been able to parole them back into the country to continue to pursue their asylum claims.
Juliana, going back to what you were saying about how this Tren de Aragua situation has allowed the Trump administration to sort of paint every Venezuelan migrant as a criminal, do you think that made it easier then for federal agents to just sort of arbitrarily take someone like Franco and say, oh, that tattoo looks like, you know, a Tren de Aragua tattoo, and therefore we're just going to accuse you of being a gangster?
Yes, yes. And if you see the comments in the publications for news and stuff, you will see people commenting, and it's the same stuff that they're saying on TV. People is repeating that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm sure.
Right. Martin, finally then, what recourse do you and other attorneys representing these deported Venezuelan migrants have now? If deportees like Franco Caraballo are proven not to be Tren de Aragua terrorists, is there any possibility of redress of this situation?
At this point, where all our hope rests on Judge Boasberg's authority and the judiciary's enforcement arm to be able to bring these individuals back so that they can have their due process the way that our Constitution mandates.
What are the chances of that, do you think?
I want to be hopeful, but seeing how things have played out over time, you know, things look grim.
Martin Rosenau and Juliana Taramasco are immigration attorneys in Coconut Grove. Many thanks to you both.
Thank you, Tim. It's been a pleasure.
Still to come, if radio and TV Marti will no longer be heard in communist Cuba, what should be? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. 4 decades ago, under the Reagan administration, radio and TV Marti were created as a sort of Cuban version of Radio Free Europe. That was the U.S. government-sponsored broadcaster that was heard behind the Iron Curtain. Radio and TV Marti's mission was to undermine Cuba's communist dictatorship by broadcasting Spanish-language news and pro-democracy messaging into the island. But Marti's effectiveness has come into question. TV Marti, for example, is rarely seen in Cuba because the regime can jam its signal. That perhaps made it easier for the Trump administration this month to put Radio and TV Marti on its government reduction chopping block. Radio Marti, in fact, is now off the air. But we're hearing there may be plans to salvage the outlets. Either way, the question is, if not Marti, then what? How does the U.S. challenge Cuba's repressive regime on the airwaves moving forward? What do you think? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio to consider all this is Andy Gomez, himself a Cuban exile and the former director of the University of Miami's Institute for Cuban and Cuban-American Studies. Andy, how are you?
Hey, good to see you, Tim.
Andy, remind us what Radio and TV Marti's original mission was and how it was supposed to be carried out.
Well, as you said to begin with, it was created during the Reagan administration. It was to combat the totalitarian regime and provide the Cuban people with reliable information coming from the exile community. But we have to understand that Radio and TV Marti became a political power symbol for the exile community against their regime.
And I want to get to that. But as you've pointed out before, Radio and TV Marti originally were pretty potent symbols of the Cuban exile community's resistance to Cuba's communist dictatorship. And you've also pointed out that these outlets have had very good journalists on their roster. What were the positives about Radio and TV Marti that we should keep in mind before we enter into a discussion about where it went off the rails?
TV Marti was never seen in Cuba. Mm-hmm. You know, the Cuban government was able to block it. What I just found out was that TV Marti ceased to exist 4.5 years ago. Mm-hmm. So from 1985, even though it was not seen in Cuba, it still remained on the air. And a lot of the people here in other parts saw what was being broadcasted. It was not until 2021 mm-hmm. that Radio Marti changed its platform to more of a social media. But we have to understand that by then, the Cubans had access to the internet in 1996.
Right, yeah.
So information was already coming in from many sources. And since then, there are other social platforms that have become available to Cubans on the island.
I don't think it was 1996. I think you're talking about 2018 when Cubans got access to their...
In 1996... the internet became available.
Okay, right. I'm talking about expanded iPhone. Right, exactly.
It was expanded in 2018.
Right. So a lot of that, those developments sort of made Radio and TV Marti kind of obsolete as we came into the 21st century?
Well, not only obsolete, but the fall of the Soviet Union, particularly for young Cubans, the fall of the Soviet Union created what I call a psychological contradiction mm-hmm. from what they have been brought up to believe to the reality of the world. So now all the information that was going into the island had a high level of mistrust, not just from Miami, but from other parts of the world. Right. They begin to question not only what they were taught in terms of the ideology and indoctrination, but the information that was going in.
Right. I know one of the criticisms then that you have brought up about radio and TV, Marti, is that its content was perhaps a little bit too geared toward the exile community instead of Cubans on the island.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
How so?
Absolutely. Well, for example, and let me be very clear. The issue of democracy, we have to understand. And let me preface my remarks by saying that as a Cuban, born in Cuba and a very proud Cuban-American, there's nothing more that I would like to see democracy in Cuba.
Sure.
But we have to understand that after 66 years, you can't build democracy overnight. Not only that, we didn't have a democracy before 1959, mm-hmm. and I can go further down the line. Mm-hmm. So the information that was going in, I thought it was very misleading and had very, very no purpose.
But you've also said it didn't have a lot of relevance for Cubans' daily lives on the island. You know, their personal struggles, as you put it, every day.
But not only when we say Cubans, we have to also, and this is where I think there was a mistake made. You know, Cuba today, of the 10.3 million people, 62% are Afro-Cuban or mulatto. Mm-hmm. And I think there was very little
That's a good
in
point.
Terms of programming towards them. Very little program towards the youth. Mm-hmm. So I think today, before they were taken off the air, what Radio Marti was doing was trying to catch up in the social platforms and trying to be more relevant to the reality of what was going on inside the island.
Mm-hmm. Now, did those failures of radio and TV, Marti, that's the sort of lack of relevance that you've just been discussing, did that make it easier for the new Trump administration than to put them in these outlets in its Doge crosshairs, as it were, and decide to dismantle radio and TV, Marti, even though the Cuban exile community has been such a staunch supporter of President Trump and this idea that he'd be tough on the Cuban regime?
We have to remember that not only the first cycle, but in the second cycle, or the second campaign of President Trump, the majority of the Cuban American community voted for him.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
I think that the step that he took by completely taking it off the air, like he's done with many other programs, mm-hmm. you know, you needed to do an assessment. You needed to do an audit to see whether the money that was being invested mm-hmm. Was making an impact on the purpose of the mission of Radio Marti.
Right.
And that's where I think the mistake was made, making a decision to take him completely off the air without really having proper information, good information in terms of the impact they were doing.
And precisely because the Cuban community has supported President Trump as much as it has, as you pointed out, what kind of a psychological blow then was it to suddenly wake up and hear that President Trump was doing away with radio and TV, Marti?
I can tell you it's not been a pleasant one. Many people have started to question why. I think I indicated to you my high-placed sources in Washington, D.C. are now telling me that Secretary of State Marco Rubio has taken an interest in the subject.
And I want to get to that right now. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with former University of Miami Cuban Studies Institute Director Andy Gomez about the Trump administration's apparent closure, or at least dismantling, of radio and TV Marti. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So, again, Andy, you just mentioned to me earlier that you're hearing rumblings from Washington that this dismantling, if not eventual shutdown of radio and TV Marti, may not be a done deal. Cuban-American Republican Miami Congressman Mario Diaz-Balart told Telemundo as much this week. What are you hearing then, particularly with regard to, as you just said, Secretary of State Marco Rubio's sudden involvement in this, himself, we know, being a Miami Cuban American?
Well, you know, Mario's comment was, I think it caught all of them by completely off guard. Mm-hmm. And the process that how it worked or how it's worked in Washington before, when a decision is going to be made at this level at the White House, someone in the White House is going to notify that congressional delegation of those members of Congress that are going to be impacted by that decision. Apparently, that never happened. Mm-hmm. And it caught Mario, Maria Elvira, and Carlos Jimenez, wow, the three Cuban Americans, completely off guard.
That is strange that they were not consulted about this. Yeah,
I have no proof to that.
Yeah, but if they weren't consulted,
based on the interview that I saw Mario give Telemundo, it leads me to believe that he was not aware that this was going to happen.
Well, do you think Secretary of State Rubio's involvement, if that involvement does happen, could he maybe reverse course on this decision about radio and TV, Marti, do you think?
Marco's in a tough spot because, again, you hear, number one, budget cuts, budget cuts, budget cuts. Then you also hear, which I, coming from an academic world, I truly believe the funds should follow public policy, in this case, foreign policy. Mm-hmm. And that has not been the case consistently throughout the year.
Right, because as you said, a lot of times the content on radio and TV, Marti, was directed more for the Cuban exile community here rather than for the Cuban community on the island itself.
I would say it was to please the Cuban-American community more than to have an impact inside the island.
But if they are on a campaign now to save radio and TV, Marti, up in Washington, is one of their arguments going to be, as you pointed out earlier, Radio Marti did change the way it was doing things in terms of forming its content, making itself more relevant to Cubans on the island. And as you pointed out to me, the numbers in terms of viewership and listenership on the island seem to go up as a result of that change they were making. Is that one of the arguments they're going to make up in Washington?
When I took a look at the numbers, to be honest with you, I was very impressed. Because since they made the switch, mm-hmm, it seems like they're having a greater impact inside the island by having created this social platform. Uh-huh. And I have to tell you, Radio Marti has some very good journalists right now trying to make the information going into the island much more relevant than before.
Right. Things like maybe how to start a private business, things of that nature.
That is one of the issues.
Yeah.
I mean, mm-hmm, the young Cubans on the islands are hungry,
right,
for information.
And we should say there are fewer and fewer young Cubans on the island.
Well, you know, but there's still quite a bit.
Yeah.
And they're hungry for reliable information. Mm-hmm. What concerns me is that their level of trust continues to decline. Mm-hmm. There are so many social platforms today that, and not all of them are consistent.
Right.
So if you're listening to all of them, how are you going to take that information and be able to apply it?
So radio and TV, Marti, need to compete with the youngsters on all of the social platforms, just like we have to do here in many ways.
Exactly. You have Cubané, you have Cyber Cuba, you have El Toque, you have even Cuban influencer Otaola.
Yeah,
which, you know, it blows my mind how that kind of information, but he's still very popular.
Mm-hmm. Now, finally, Andy, in just the minute we have left, we're also hearing that non-radio and TV democracy promoting groups that work with Cuba, like the National Endowment for Democracy and the International Republic Institute, they're going to get some of their funding back from the Trump administration after it looked like they would get shut down on the island, too. What do you make of that news in just the 30 seconds we have left?
Some of the programs are worthwhile. Some of the other programs, personally and professionally, I have questioned throughout the years in terms of its impact, in terms of its sustainability, in terms of their capability to bring about change on the island.
In terms of undermining the regime.
Undermining the regime, and the regime knows that.
But it's not just undermining regime. They're also doing things like helping prisoners, you know, political prisoners and their families, right?
But, you know, a question, Tim, that was raised the other day of one of these groups, how much of the money really goes into Cuba?
Yeah.
None.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, Andy. Andy Gomez is the former director of the University of Miami's Institute for Cuban and Cuban American Studies. Andy, thanks as always.
My pleasure, Tim.
Finally on the roundup, Miami-Dade is taking hip-hop to the streets. That is, the street names of Liberty City. Popular song titles and artists with Miami ties will soon serve as the namesake for over 20 Liberty City streets. That's after the Miami-Dade County Commission approved a plan this week to add a musical touch to the neighborhood's byways. The measure passed 9-3. Now, streets between Northwest 18th and 19th Avenues will be named Chase Dis Money Street, We the Best Terrace, and Bad Boys Street. A lot more fun than the Southwest 154th Terrace I live on. The changes honor Miami artists including Trick Daddy, Trina, DJ Khaled, Uncle Luke, and Rick Ross. That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with assistance from Denise Royal. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital director. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. Richard Ives answered the phones. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend and thanks for listening. Gracias. Merci. Obrigado.
WLRN.